Canadian broadcaster, educator, psychologist. He's now the new head of the psychology department at Catalina University in Vancouver, British Columbia. He's also had long-term association with the University of British Columbia and with Simon Fraser University. He's the author of two books, Alternative Realities, Crimes of Perception. He's really one of Canada's, if not Canada's leading, researchers, scholars, thinkers, writers, broadcasters around the whole Western tradition. So it's wonderful to have Leonard with us for the second half of the morning. So welcome, it's a pleasure.
Good morning, everybody. It's a delight to see you all again, or most of you. I saw a lot of you last night. Some people are arriving this morning. And I'm almost overwhelmed with a sense of honor right now. I just feel so privileged, first of all, to be here on the magical island of Sicily, sharing with you this morning some ideas concerning one of the greatest minds ever to arise from the soil of Sicily, namely Empedocles. And secondly, to follow up Dr. Jocelyn Godwin's presentation just feels to me like a great privilege. So my feet are approaching the earth again. In the meantime, hopefully you all have the handout that I prepared. If you get sleepy at any point during my presentation, you can actually catch a nap and not miss a thing. So I did think ahead about that also, the jet lag aspect of it. For those who were at our first meeting yesterday evening, I briefly mentioned the idea that, in a sense, all we have surviving from the wisdom of antiquity are fragments. It turns out that one of the juiciest sets of fragments with which we can get a little bit of a window into the lost antique wisdom comprise the fragments written by the philosopher Empedocles. So what I want to do this morning explore and piece together some of those fragments into something like a window with which we can look at some of the, at least it'll give us a taste of the what we've lost, really, what we've lost in terms of the wisdom. So before I get into details about Empedocles specifically, I want to set the stage a bit, first of all, by reminding us a wee bit about the history of the Greek presence in southern Italy and Sicily, because Empedocles was a citizen of this domain, which later on in Latin was called Magna Graecia, or Great Greece. I also want to set up two contexts that I think will help us get a little more deeply into Empedocles, namely the context of philosophy or philosophia, and the other context being the ancient mysteries. So we are questers. But it turns out we're only the latest questers to arrive here. There have been many, many waves of questers coming to this part of the world previously. One very important set of questers started from here. We can call this region Old Greece, which comprises much more than the modern country of Greece, because back in the old days, the Greek cultural sphere, the cradle of Greek civilization, comprised the shoreline of the entire Aegean Sea, which we can see here, as well as the islands in the Aegean also. And around the 8th century BCE, following what sometimes is called the Dark Ages or Dark Period in early Greek history, we have the dawn of the phase of Greek history called the Archaic Period. And one of the manifestations of this new restlessness that grabbed the Greeks in the 8th century BCE was colonization. And there were really two main waves of or directions in the colonization from Old Greece. One wave going into the northeast, planting colonies around the shores of the Black Sea. The other major wave going west across the Mediterranean Sea. And I'm curious, how many people were on the island of Samothrake a few years back? Look at that. This is terrific. So welcome back to the great Open Center Conference on the island of Samothrake. So that was many of our excuses to spend some time in the old Greek territory there. The engine that ran, that drove the colonization waves actually was not one engine, but many. There are many reasons for the new colonists to go forth. Political tensions in the old cities, drought, seeking economic opportunities, threat of external invasion. So the colonists had many stories that motivated them to head out on their quest for new lives in other parts of the world. Most of the leaders of the colonizing organizations, before leaving Old Greece, made a pit stop at Delphi to consult the oracle at Delphi. In effect, the god Apollo. So here we have the depiction of the prophetess of Apollo. And so the founders of the colonies would get direction from the god Apollo in terms of what to look for in locating the new colonies. So in a certain sense, we can regard the colonization of Magna Graecia as a project of the god Apollo, as much as of any human consciousness involved. And other supernatural powers were called on, also daimonic and other forces to guide the colonists. And a certain psychological quality was also very prized by people venturing into the unknown. The ancient Greek word metis is one of the words referring to this this quality that was very valued in the first colonists, and as I say, anyone who goes into the unknown. The term metis, one of the meanings of it, is a kind of comprehensive awareness of the present moment that manages to grasp in a rather panoramic fashion the possibilities and limitations of any particular situation. And you can imagine this would be rather handy in going into the unknown, where precedent might not lead you to make the best choice in that situation. So the notion is one of acting perfectly in accord with that situation, very, very specifically, acting in just the right way, in just the right moment, this faculty of metis, which was very prized. Again, because it's based on the present, it's not based on rules that might have worked in another situation in the past, the outcome of metis is impossible to predict, and sometimes comes across as deceptive and even has a bit of a tricksterous quality. The point is that the guidance of Apollo, the guidance of other invisible spiritual forces, and the awakening of this faculty of metis taken together hopefully assured the colonists a really strong foundation for their new lives in unknown territories. And so many of those colonists ended up in this part of the world. Of course, in the Greek language, the Greek presence in southern Italy, the shoreline of southern Italy, and about the eastern two-thirds of the island of Sicily, in Greek was known as Megale Hellas, and then translated into Latin. Most people today refer to it as Magna Graecia, so Great Greece, throughout all these different areas. And look, we're on the map. Here we are today. Syracuse, which was one of the first of the Greek colonies founded in this part of the world. The traditional date of the founding of Syracuse is around 734 BCE. So as I say, we're just the latest questers to wash up on these shores. What the people who arrived found was an area that was extremely volcanically active. And perhaps if you went up Etna, you noticed that. So volcanoes, active volcanoes and bubbling pits of mud, sulfurous vents, all kinds of evidence for a very active underworld in this particular domain. And in fact, the Greeks who moved here and the people who were here before the Greeks arrived really quickly had a sense of proximity, almost intimacy with the underworld. Douglas Kenning, I think, will say more tomorrow or the next day about the importance of the specific character of the landscape and, shall we say, the presence of the landscape that manifests. And so this sense of closeness to the underworld really heavily inflects the culture of Magna Graecia and probably the culture of anyone who lives in these particular parts. The immigrants from Old Greece carried many of their gods to New Greece. Greece to Magna Graecia. But again, because of the presence of the landscape itself, these gods of old Greece were transformed. So you can think of the old Greek gods almost like seeds being planted in a new type of soil and producing very different characteristics, particularly the Greek gods associated with the underworld, not too surprising. And you may already know, Persephone, for example, features very strongly in the consciousness of Magna Graecia. The Greek poet Pindar named Sicily Persephone's Island. And very close to where we are right now, the Fonte Chiani is the traditional location of the place where Hades and Persephone plunged into the underworld. And so if you have a chance to go there, maybe throw a lamb in or something like that, you'll be following the precedent, and then run away quickly. Oh, there she is. So then Persephone, for example, is honored in the coinage of Syracuse over and over again. Goddess of the underworld. Here are some of the major colonies that were founded during this period of Greek colonization. It lasted approximately 300 years from Cumae up to the north and all the way around the coast there. And of course, on the island of Sicily, as I mentioned, most of the settlements on this slide, the eastern two-thirds or so, are Greek colonies, including Syracuse there. Of course, the Greeks were not the first arrivals here. There's very strong groups of indigenous cultures were already in Sicily and southern Italy when the Greeks arrived. The Phoenicians, particularly those who founded Carthage, had a strong presence here. There's evidence of Egyptian influence in this part of the world. Later on, we have the Romans rolling through, and it keeps going. So one of the images often used to think of Magna Graecia is the image of the mixing bowl. In Greek, the term is the krater. And of course, krater anglicizes as crater. And so the bowl of the volcano is also to be thought of as a kind of mixing bowl. And so nowhere on Earth has been more of a mixing bowl than the place that we are right now, with all these different cultural influences. In other words, all these different images of human possibility. A Greek would look at a Phoenician would look at a Lucanian and think, well, that's a human being, but that's a human being very unlike myself. And that kind of encounter with the other can really awaken another type of quest, not just a physical quest, but an esoteric quest to explore the possibilities of one's own existence. Possible selves that we can acquire. So this area, a great crater or mixing bowl of human possibility, setting off one of the world's most intense phases of questing, esoteric questing. So it's correct that we are here today. So we can imagine all these influences flowing in from all different directions, mixing and producing hybrids and strange new possibilities. And Empedocles was one of the people who came out of all of this. One of the colonies was named Akragas, and I'm hoping many of you, how many people have visited Agrigento Akragas already? Just wondering. Quite a few. How many people are going on the post-conference tour? Many more. Excellent. Your minds will be blown. It's fabulous. So Empedocles was born in the city, the Greek city of Akragas, one of these colonies. As far as I know, there are no ancient representations of Empedocles, so this is my favorite, obviously relatively recent, but he looks like a little Taoist sage living on a cloud, so we'll pretend he looked like that. The colony of Gela was founded, another one of the very early Greek colonies at this particular time period, and about a century later, Gela decided to found another colony of its own, and hence the founding of Akragas. This was actually founded from a city in Sicily in 582 BC. Possibly one of the motivations was to block the eastward spread influence from the city of Selinus, which is another early and very powerful Greek colony. Some say there are economic advantages to founding the city of Akragas, but nonetheless, there's where it ended up. A very interesting choice of location. The town was bracketed by two rivers, the river Hupsas and the river Akragas, which flowed together and then to the bottom or south of the slide flow into the Mediterranean Sea. To the north, the city is defined by a high ridge where the Acropolis was built, and down slope from the high ridge, another ridge is now known as the famous Valley of the Temples. A whole line of fantastic sacred buildings was planted along that particular ridge. And you will be astonished to visit that, that place. The poet Pindar identified Acragas at its height as the most beautiful city in the world. And there's enough there to confirm that if you visit. I love the coins. Most of the coins of Acragas have the freshwater crab as their symbol. So we can think of Acragas as the city of the crab, the home of Empedocles, and just a little tiny bit of the historical background. For about the first while, Acragas was ruled by tyrants. Some tyrants are good, some tyrants are bad at this particular period, but the best tyrant in the history of this city was Theron, who was regarded as quite enlightened, and as long as you didn't get in his way, very beneficent. One of the most important events, really, in the history of Greek civilization as a whole happened in Sicily in 480 BC. If you're a student in Greek history, you probably are thinking of another very important event in 480 BC. But this one, the great battle at Himera on the north coast of Sicily, the Phoenicians of Carthage were extending their influence eastward, and Theron of Acragas teamed up with the tyrant of Syracusa, and together their army defeated the Carthaginians at Himera. And that's a real hinge of history, because possibly we'd all be speaking Punic today if the Phoenicians had won that battle. Who knows? But one important outcome of this was that Theron was allotted a certain number of the captive Carthaginians as slaves. He marched them all south to Acragas and used them as his building team to construct those fabulous temples that you have seen or that you will see. Empedocles was approximately 15 years old at the time of the Battle of Himera, so we can start to situate him as a lucky fellow who happened to live during the golden age of Acragas, the high point of the cultural blossoming of his city in the 4th century. And so after Theron, mostly it was peaceful and a real opportunity for undisturbed questing of various kinds, shall we say. Oh well, all good things come to an end. Yay, they're liberated. And then the end of all stories around here. So, a little bit of a glimpse of the background of Acragas, its beauty. What do we know about Empedocles as a person? Not very much. Again, only fragments. Do we have, this is a guess of his birth and death dates. No one knows for sure, but we get a sense. Various little bits of rumor and documentation from antiquity suggest that he was actually known as an outstanding poet, and we're about to examine the fragments of his surviving writings, which are poems. Renowned as a speaker, Aristotle, in fact, named Empedocles the founder of rhetoric. So apparently he had the gift of gab as a philosopher. We have to watch out what that term means, of course. As a healer, he was also aligned with the Democratic Party in Acragas. Ironically, he became so popular that they wanted him as the tyrant. And he declined. And that gives us a lovely humanity looking into the mirror at itself, I think. But he declined this particular petition. He had some kind of connection with another of the Greek colonies on the mainland, a place called Thurii, which may be significant in understanding him. I'll tell you a bit more about Thurii in a moment. How he died is unknown. There are all kinds of interesting legends concerning his death. Some say that he died in his old age in Thurii. There's, of course, a more famous story that survived to the present day. Some of you may have heard this story yesterday or knew it already. The old tale that he jumped into the cone at on Mount Etna, and the Torre del Filosofo, the peak of the philosopher, is actually named in memory of this alleged act of Empedocles. As we'll see, there's more than one way to interpret that old legend. It doesn't have to be taken as a literal suicide. There's where Thurii is, by the way, for future reference. Thurii was the last major Greek colony founded, so the founding of Thurii kind of closes off the colonization period of Magna Graecia, founded by Athens and some other allied cities in 443 BC. Not a whole lot to see if you visit Thurii today, Roman city built on top of it. Some of the Romans had some awfully interesting things in their basements, though, as we will see. As we will. Okay, so enough of the historical background. We have some sense about the Greek presence, where we are right now. Now, one of the background contexts. I'm having the experience, my voice is fading in and out on this thing. It really is. A little light is on. I wonder if I actually need it. I'll keep using it for now. As Jocelyn mentioned before our break, this term philosophia is associated with Pythagoras. It's said that he actually coined this word, the love of wisdom, sophia, the quest for wisdom. Unfortunately, in its form of the word philosophy, many of us, I think, have been terribly misled about the nature of ancient philosophy or philosophia. Probably philosophy today is most treasured as the fountain of reason, and many of us have this cartoon running in our head, ancient philosophers, well, they were dudes who were dressed up in togas and they stood around very coldly arguing with each other, you know, trying to score points, and that's what philosophy is all about. Well, of course, that's nonsense. It is true that one of the great gifts of ancient philosophy was indeed and is indeed the foundation of logic and reason. But placed in appropriate context, logic and reason are means to an end, and that end is not scoring debating points. So this is important, but there's much more to it. Philosophia really was talking about a quest for the optimal way of being a human. And of course, that involves exploring the possibilities of being a human. So often what we think about as philosophy today was only an aspect of this broader and deeper quest. And certainly from what Jocelyn mentioned about Pythagoras, if we were listening, Pythagoras didn't really resemble the cartoon philosopher that many of us have stuck in our heads, and certainly neither did Empedocles. Here are some of the other ancient philosophers who are thought to have influenced Empedocles. I'm not going to say much about most of these people. Heraclitus of Ephesus and Anaximander of Miletus were philosophers who lived in old Greece. Parmenides and Xenophanes, Xenophanes and Pythagoras, of course, weren't born in Magna Graecia, but they ended up here. Parmenides was a native child of Magna Graecia. Focus on the city of Elea, another of the early colonies, just for a moment. Elea has connections with both Parmenides and Xenophanes. And it's a pretty place to visit. Marjorie and I just spent 2 weeks there. So Xenophanes, he actually came from old Greece. He escaped the Persian invasion, spent the rest of his life wandering around. A contemporary of Pythagoras, Xenophanes was. And he deserves a minute or two's mention at this Open Center conference, because I'm going to propose to Ralph that the New York Open Center cast a bronze statue of Xenophanes for the doorway or something. There's reason for that. Remarkable fellow. I'd love to go on and on about him, actually, as well, Xenophanes. Sometimes I think about him as the ancient equivalent of George Carlin or Lenny Bruce. Because what Xenophanes actually managed to do is, for decades, he wandered from city to city, making himself welcome in the aristocratic courts, because he was apparently wildly entertaining in the things that he would say. But he was also extremely provocative. He apparently was unafraid of really challenging and questioning all kinds of assumptions of the age. And we have some fragments of what he was up to. One of his provocative, not so provocative anymore, but at the time apparently it was riot material, is that in one of his routines he pointed out, isn't it interesting that the gods of the Greeks look like Greek people, but the gods of the Thracians look like Thracians, the gods of the Ethiopians look like Ethiopians, and probably the cats and dogs could have gods that look like cats and dogs. What's going on here? And And so, in other words, highlighting the fact that we cast our gods in our own image. And Xenophanes did not reject the reality of the gods. He just thought that we were wallpapering the reality of the gods with pictures of ourselves. That probably got him run out of one or two courts, but still, apparently, he was very funny. He furthermore went on to say, however, that there is an ultimate divine reality, and that ultimate divine reality is, in some inconceivable sense, a unity. The oneness of all things is the source of sacredness and the ultimate reality, the ultimate divinity. Also, in an inconceivable fashion, he taught that this unity can be identified with diversity. This is the age-old mystical problem of the one and the many. If you sense that there's an ultimate reality that is one thing, what do you do with the fact that it certainly doesn't look that way? We have an experience of oneness, some of us. We have an experience of diversity, probably all of us. And what do you do with that apparently irreconcilable set of experiences? So he didn't answer the problem, but he posed it very clearly, perhaps the earliest person in the Western tradition to set this particular problem. Furthermore, he apparently stated or hinted that if the ultimate reality is one thing, that means that that's the only thing we experience. So in other words, there's only one object of experience, regardless of how it seems. To make matters even kinkier, if there's only one thing, there can only be one experiencer. So there's only one object of experience, and there's also only one subject of experience. In some inconceivable way, it's the same thing. Thank you, Xenophanes. He is also known as the father of insomnia for thoughtful people. Just one more glimpse about Xenophanes. He said a very interesting thing. He noted that in our human condition, everything we experience directly is only apparent. It's a form of dokos, or appearance, is cast over all things. And we're kind of stuck with that. So as human beings, we have a limitation. We're only given a part of the story. But, he said, and this is the important part, Ralph, he said that even if we cannot succeed in knowing the whole of reality, the whole truth, in the way that the gods know, we still should go on a quest for it. Because questing in itself has intrinsic value. And that is why I expect to see that bronze statue coming up beside the open center. Yet the gods have not revealed to us all things to us from the beginning. But by questing, we find out better in time. So Xenophanes could be, at least in terms of documentation, is the earliest person in the Western tradition who puts us on the kind of quest that's brought us here this morning. There you go. I'm not going to talk about Parmenides with you this morning. Time doesn't permit. If you're intrigued by Parmenides, I'm going to be chatting a bit more about him tomorrow afternoon. But he was a native son of the beautiful ancient city of Elea. And he didn't look like this. But he did say a bunch of profound things. Again, I'm not going to unpack this for you this morning. Various little snippets are known about him. Like Empedocles, his surviving fragments comprise poetry. Very interesting poem indeed. Parmenides is regarded as the first person actually to advance a logical argument in support of his position anywhere. That's a fair achievement. Intriguingly, Parmenides himself apparently denied it. He said, "I didn't come up with this logical argument. I got it from the goddess Persephone." So that's part of the fun, is that the rational tradition apparently was a revelation from a goddess. But as you can see very briefly here, in his poem, Parmenides wrestled with this issue of how it is and how it seems, and what do we do with that situation as human beings.
I'm sorry, can you go back to that last slide for just another moment? I didn't
before. Well, I'm sure you won't, because I'm not really saying much about it. I'm just drawing to your attention the structure of the poem here. I'm not going to unpack it this morning, but as you can see the last two bullets, he is talking about the truth, or aletheia, how things actually are, versus how things seem. He's using the word doxa here. And I do need to rumble on, actually. And so his conclusion, or at least one way of understanding his conclusion, again, is that aletheia, the ultimate reality, there is only one thing. So So he's sounding like Xenophanes here, but he brings it forward in an intriguing way. All of this is just an overblown background to Empedocles, who I'm anxious to get back to at this point. And I'm so fortunate in following Jocelyn Godwin, I don't have to say anything about Pythagoras. Here is Croton, where Pythagoras moved to eventually, and Metapontum, where he's thought to have died. So another influence possibly on Empedocles, so Philosophia, as Jocelyn mentioned, the notion of cosmos, the world of the senses as an adornment, the word cosmos prior allegedly to Pythagoras' use was an ornament, like a brooch, a decoration on a robe. And what an interesting use of the word to consider the entire universe as a cosmos, a kind of visible decoration of some invisible glory. So that's very nice. The notion of rebirth or reincarnation has already come up. The notion of a Pythagorean community with layers of initiation has also come up this morning as well. So this is all background to getting to Empedocles. One more little background snippet before we go into Empedoclean detail, the ancient mysteries. And many of you know a lot about the ancient mystery traditions, coming from an old Greek verb meaning to close, such as to close your mouth, because it's secret what happens in the mysteries. Gatherings, sometimes with large numbers of people, in certain mystery traditions it might just be two people. Generally, in a nutshell, the notion was to enact a myth of some kind, a story connected to a deity, and through that enactment participate in the divinity, perhaps on some level become identified with aspects of the divinity, and experience a transformation of one's sense of self or sense of mind. In a nutshell, many of the mysteries were something like that. The Eleusinian Mysteries, the most famous of all of the mystery traditions, not practiced in Magna Graecia, of course, because you had to go to Eleusis, but we have evidence that some of the Magna Graecians were certainly intrigued. This masterpiece of the ceramic art, you have to go to Russia to see it now, by the way, the Queen of Vases coming from Kume, but it really is a masterpiece, and it turns out to depict hints about the mysteries on its surface. Probably more to the point in Magna Graecia, here's Walter Burkert's lovely pithy definition, mysteries as initiation rituals of a voluntary personal secret character aimed at a change of mind through experience of a secret. Orpheus, very important legendary character, and in Magna Graecia, Orpheus becomes very, very central to mystery practices. And again, remember, we're in a place of close connection with the underworld, and I'm sure you know some of the stories of Orpheus. His musical abilities, magical abilities were so powerful that as a living person, he could actually go into the underworld and still come back alive. That rarely happens. Furthermore, sometimes he can go into the underworld and actually retrieve a soul from the underworld and bring her back, as he allegedly did with his wife Eurydice. You probably know the later version of that where he failed to bring her back, but there are earlier versions where he succeeded. The point is that Orpheus allegedly went to the underworld and came back. So if I want to know what it's like down there, I should actually ask Orpheus. He's like an eyewitness. And so the Orphic mysteries built up around the figure of Orpheus. And as initiates, if we somehow can tune into Orpheus, imitate Orpheus, live like Orpheus, then we can acquire the wisdom of Orpheus, which is intimately connected with journeys to the underworld. And the underworld is a place where the transformation occurs. Thurii. I told you it was interesting if you had a basement in Thurii, because Thurii has produced more of these Orphic gold tablets than anywhere else on Earth. These are found at burials, probably of Orphic initiates, gold tablets with Greek writing. And I regard these as the cheat sheets for the ultimate final exam. I'm tempted to ask for a show of hands as to how many of you have used cheat sheets. I'm a university professor. The truth would probably freak me right out. But you probably know what they are. And so the final exam here is what happens after death.
what happens after death. So there is inscriptions allegedly from lost Orphic texts here, which actually give instructions on how to have a good outcome after death. And Thuri seems to have a very close connection with this tradition, and Pedocles has a close connection with Thuri. This becomes relevant, I think. Final bit of background, Jocelyn Godwin already mentioned Theon of Smyrna, who wrote about many things, including the ancient mysteries. Often the ancient mysteries were divided into three, but Theon in one of his writings divides it into five levels or layers of initiation, the first being the level of purification, which was before the secrecy started. So purification is public. You're kind of invited into the mysteries, but first you must be purified. The second layer is where the secrecy begins. This is private initiation, the transmission of the secret teachings. And then once you have the secret teachings, you have to oversee those teachings in your life as they ripen. Then hopefully there is full ripening and crowning. And of course, crowning signifies royalty or perhaps even a recognition of divinity. And then the most mature stage, living with the gods. Well, really, the only beings that live with gods are other gods. So this is hinting at a kind of recognition of a divinity in one's own identity. And so this is a bit of relevant background. Will we ever get to Empedocles? Yes, right now. All right. Empedocles wrote poems, just like the rest of ancient wisdom. We only have fragments of these poems. This is a juicy fragment, and it's amazing how recently it was made available, as recently as 1997. So some of these dusty old studies continue in new ways. This is the, and you can see how fragmented, this is just part of it, but it's pretty fragmented. And this is the only fragment we've got that looks like, when it wasn't a fragment, it was an entire work of Empedocles. The rest of our evidence about what Empedocles wrote consists of quotations, very brief quotations, in the works of other ancient authors. So the little wee bits, and this is great for scholars because then you can go on for centuries and crank out endless numbers of doctoral dissertations arguing about how to put the fragments in order, how to translate the fragments, how many poems there actually were. So this is part of the industry of scholarship. But I think there's a near consensus at this point that we have fragments of two poems by Parmenides. By Empedocles. One titled Katharmoi, or Purification. The other one titled Periphusis, which could be called On Nature or On the Nature of Things. In fact, the second title seems to be applied to a lot of ancient poems. But nonetheless, it looks like we have glimpses into two poems here. So let's try and figure out what we've got. Some scholars have suggested that the first poem is actually connected with the first level of a mystery tradition, purification. So let's take a look a little bit at what we've got as we fly over beautiful Akragas. And consider the surviving opening lines of this poem and see if it fits any kind of cartoon version of a philosopher. Friends who live in the great city of yellow Akragas, up on the heights of the Acropolis, caring for good deeds, I give you greetings. So it's a public address, right? An immortal god, mortal no more, I go about, honored by all, as is suitable, crowned with ribbons and fresh garlands. Well, that's quite an intro. I don't know if you've ever taken a philosophy course. Did your professor introduce him or herself like this? No. So there's something very interesting going on here immediately. What could Empedocles mean by stating that he's an immortal god, mortal no more? Well, a hint with the background of the mysteries. Remember those levels of initiation, what I said about the fifth one. And by all whom I come upon as I enter their prospering towns, by men and women I am revered. They follow me in their thousands, asking where lies the road to benefit, some desiring prophecies, while others ask to hear the word of healing for every kind of illness. So this kind of philosophy is promising prophecy and healing. Try asking for that in your Wittgenstein course. And we go back to the Orphic tablet. 3 is a very interesting line that kind of jumps out in the cheat sheet instructions. Here's something that's promised. Happy and blessed one, in other words, initiate of the mysteries of Orpheus, now that you're dead, you shall be a god instead of a mortal. So the Orphic tablets are setting the stage for if you can get to the underworld and know what you're doing, the happy outcome actually is immortalization. And it's using the same phrasing as in Empedocles' poem, a god, not a mortal anymore. So one reading of this is that Empedocles is presenting himself as an initiate, inviting people to his mysteries. First of all, you have to undergo purification. The second poem that survived, On the Nature of Things, some scholars have linked to the transmission phase of the mysteries. Now, this was a private phase. It was not public. And interestingly, Empedocles addresses the second poem to an individual, a fellow named Pausanias. So this clearly was supposed to be a private exchange, not a public one, fitting with this level of initiation. And let's take a look for a moment at what Empedocles promises Pausanias will get out of the deal if he actually receives the transmission of the teachings properly. You shall learn all the remedies that there are for ills and defense against old age, since for you alone I will accomplish all this. Okay. And you shall stay the force of the unwearied winds which sweep over the earth and lay waste the fields with their blasts. And then, if you wish, you shall bring back breezes and win requital. So, it looks like weather control over the powers of nature, is actually part of the promise as well. And it's starting to sound perhaps a little shamanic, rather than cartoon philosophical. After black rain, you shall cause drought for me in due season, and then after summer drought, cause air inhabiting tree nourishing streams. So more climate control or weather control being promised, but there's something subtle in here that's worth noting, I think. This might seem like someone who's engaging in a pushing against the natural rhythms. Here's someone who has acquired special powers and is interfering with the rhythms of nature. But note in due season. What's actually being described here may not be someone who's acquiring powers with which he or she can manipulate the forces of nature. What may be hinted at here is that the outcome of this initiation is you become identified with the source of the forces of nature. In other words, a change of identity. Then you're controlling nature because you are nature, not because you're some magician trying to engage in a battle against the forces of nature. So it's a very interesting hint. Things may not be as they seem in this particular promise. And yikes! You shall bring from Hades the life force of a dead person. Well, who's done that before? Orpheus has done that before. So this does seem to be pointing at an initiatic transformation of the sense of self into an immortalized condition that's associated with Orpheus. So, with that, let's spend a bit of time looking at some of the actual content of these teachings. I suspect I will run out of time, and the glare of Carrie resembles that of Medusa. I've learned from previous conferences, so I'm going to cut off very abruptly, I'm pretty sure, at some point. So, in terms of the cosmos that Empedocles described, most famously he talks about these four elements, that everything is composed of the four elements. He doesn't actually use the word element. Translated, he uses the word root, the four roots, as in the roots of a plant. So first little gloss on this, if one wanted to gloss, is that the elements themselves aren't just sort of like dead atoms floating around, but they actually contain a sort of potential, right? Because things grow out of their roots. So earth, air, water, and fire, everything made of these things. Another detail that sometimes gets lost is that Empedocles identifies the four roots with four deities. So again, we're not just talking about little atoms of stuff floating around, we're actually being set up to approach the four roots or elements as, in some sense, forms of divine presence. And so the four deities that the elements get identified with, Zeus with air, his wife Hera with earth, and then we see two Sicilian terms used for the Greek gods, Nestis who is Persephone for water, and Idunus, who is Hades for fire. So the roots of reality we have here. Now the elements themselves are eternal, but they constantly change in relationships. They mix, they separate endlessly in four elements, or roots, four deities, if you want. And you might have heard from the alchemical tradition that the perfect balance of the four elements, when they're mixed together perfectly, you end up with gold. Empedocles had a slightly different idea, or maybe the same depending on how you interpret gold. He said that if the ratio is perfect between the four roots, you get blood. Blood is the perfect mixture of the roots. And of course, unfolding from this is the great tradition of the four elements which underpins ancient physics, medicine, alchemy, psychology, the gift that keeps on giving, Empedocles' four elements. Now these elements continue to mix and separate, but not at random. There are two universal forces that govern the mixing and separating, and they alternate in strength so that we have a kind of circulation. And Empedocles identified these two forces, one of which, the force of attraction or mixing, he called philotes, or love. He identified that force with the goddess Aphrodite. And the other he called Nikos, or strife. The surviving fragments do not name the god, so I just nominated Ares as a likely suspect. But the idea is that the powers actually alternate in strength. So at some points, strife is dominant and love is very weak. At another point, love is dominant, strife is very weak, and there's a great alternation between these two. So at the period of greatest domination of love, the universe really has no structure whatsoever. It's basically a ball of blood because the elements are drawn together and they're perfectly mixed. I imagine it looks like this at this particular point. So there's no differentiation whatsoever. There's just a kind of unconscious, perfect blend of all of the elements. But then as strife increases and love weakens, we have things starting to spread apart and define a cosmos or universe. As things continue to spread apart, we have the emergence of life, as we want. And as they continue to spread further apart, everything is torn to pieces, and you cannot have life anymore, and ultimately you can't even have a structured universe anymore until you reach the period of the dominance of Nikos. And then it goes in the other direction as love becomes stronger. So the world dominated by Nikos, the four roots or elements separated into concentric unmixed rings, and there can be no life in such a cosmos looking like this. So back and forth it goes. This is the hypnotic part of the program. But what is that? It's a pulsation. And some people have compared it to the rhythm of breathing, that the universe breathes. When we breathe in, everything is compressed. When we breathe out, everything is separated again. So it's a powerful image of breathing. Again, someone spotted this earlier with Empedocles. It is rather reminiscent of the rhythm of yin and yang in Far Eastern tradition, when at its extremity of dominance, yin starts turning into yang and vice versa. We have that. So the world dominated by Nikos. It's an open question whether, as the world becomes attached to itself again, that comprises a second creation of a cosmos and another zoogony. Even ancient authors disagree as to whether Empedocles applied that. But whether or not he did, we can find ourselves on the picture, because obviously we live in a time of living, and so we are either during a period of increasing love or increasing strife. I leave it to you to choose where on this thing we actually are. But it looks like this. But another question is, what are we actually looking at here? We have this circulation, this mixing that's going on as things continue to swirl around. This is the crater. This is the mixing bowl. Our life is actually occurring inside the great mixing bowl. And if you know Plato's Timaeus, as Jocelyn Godwin mentioned, that image of the universe being created from the crater or mixing bowl is connected with this notion. The crater being the crater of the volcano, another notion is that we're all living in the crater of a volcano. in a certain sense, where we have these great swirlings of energy, these patterns, and then the patterns disappear again, and this is our universe. We can think of it as a mixing bowl or the cone of the cosmic volcano in a certain sense. So, another version if you are here. It's getting hotter too, isn't it? So, as I've mentioned, the two forces pulsing, inhaling, exhaling between the perfect sphere and the swirling vortex, the cosmos metaphorically, or perhaps not, as the Krater. Fragment of Empedocles suggested that somehow, taken as a whole, this great panorama of change is changeless. So, a paradox in a sense. But the whole thing, in its essence, we might say inadequately, is actually what God is. Taken as a whole, the entire thing is God, permeated by a certain faculty, which I'm not translating from the Greek. Usually this term, nous, is translated as something like mind or intellect, but I get so concerned about the misleading modern connotations of those translations that let's just call it nous. And the meaning of nous changed quite a bit throughout Greek intellectual history, but let's just be really, really simple about it and pretend that what nous means is something like a faculty that can actually grasp both the whole and also the parts of the whole in a kind of simultaneity. And so you think of the metis as the form of attention that can allow us to grasp a situation in a panoramic sense. Nous is the faculty of the mind that actually allows us to do that. And so, in the case of God, the cosmos is permeated by this faculty of nous. The important thing about that for us is that we have a nous too. And so, in effect, human nous acts as a kind of gateway or interface with the divine nous. More later, if there is a later. This God cannot be grasped by our senses, at least in their ordinary condition, nor can this God be clothed in our words in the way that we ordinarily use them. So we've got a cosmic setting. Let's zero in a little bit on what Empedocles said about life, the biological setting of our predicament. And it's quite intriguing indeed. So as with everything, so with life forms, all life forms composed of ratios of the four roots. Even Silvio Berlusconi is composed of the four elements, as are we all. And Empedocles taught a tradition of rebirth or transmigration. So we go through, and all living things go through, a whole series of life forms. This chain of reincarnation includes plants, it includes animals, it also includes gods. Now remember, this isn't the god that is the whole of the process, but Empedocles talked about divine beings that have incredibly long lifespans that are also part of the mix. So we're transmigrating, changing form in this particular way. And of course, the mixings and separations are what's actually happening. The being born and the being dying are rather illusory if we look at those things as events that are irreversible or non-repeated. And Jocelyn touched on this morning, the imponderable business of what is it that reincarnates in a picture like this. It is very hard to say. But clearly Empedocles did suggest that causal threads of mixings and separatings do exist. And somehow we become identified, each of us becomes identified with one of those threads of mixings and separatings that ripples around in the mixing bowl forever. And someone else noticed this morning, I'm certainly not the first to immediately start thinking of Eastern lore concerning reincarnation, the famous wheel of being that you can find in any Tibetan Buddhist monastery that you visit. And it also has this notion of going along a potentially endless of rebirths that include hellish incarnations, divine incarnations, human and animal incarnations as well. I'm certainly not implying a direct historical link between these cultures. I'm just putting it up as food for thought. Empedocles taught a doctrine of evolution. A according to Empedocles, as the zoogony progresses, at first what's created are little tiny things, little tiny microscopic life forms. And then over time they start sticking together to make what you might want to call multicellular life forms. So life becomes larger, life starts becoming more complex. And of course the more complex life manifests various features, characteristics, tentacles and stomachs and spines and all of this kind of stuff. According to Empedocles, those features do not emerge by any divine design. They just emerge due to the chance combination of the elements. What determines then which organisms survive and which do not survive? Their suitability to the environment in which they find themselves. Any bells ringing yet? This is actually a reasonable summary of the doctrine of evolution by natural selection, rediscovered in the 19th century by Charles Darwin and Alfred Russel Wallace. Why was it lost? Well, you can thank Aristotle, who didn't believe that species could actually change. He taught the fixity of species, therefore Empedocles had to be wrong about this. Sometimes, late at night, I think about, what if Aristotle hadn't had that opinion? Where would evolutionary biology be today if it had actually grown from the 5th century BC in this direction? So here we go. Empedocles would not disagree. Unicellular life evolving into multicellular life. This is suspicious. Look at Darwin and look at Empedocles. Disagree about there, including the grooming. All right, psychological setting. So here we are. Empedocles had amazing things to say about the nature of human mental processes as well from the fragments. How do we perceive anything? How do we have sensory awareness of anything? According to Empedocles, how it works is that the objects in the physical world give off some kind of effluence, you might say, little, some kind of radiances or bits come from the object. And if it turns out that the effluence coming from the object happens to match a receptor in the human body somewhere, that's actually how we perceive things. And it turns out that modern biological psychologists agree with Empedocles. How do you see anything? Well, you have to have substances in your retina, certain chemicals, that are tuned to resonate and trigger a chemical reaction that matches a certain wavelength of incoming light. If your chemical does not match the wavelength of light, you're blind. How do you hear anything? You have to have little tiny hairs in your inner ear which are tuned to vibrate back and forth with the rhythm of air pulsations that push your eardrum back and forth. If you don't have the little hair that's tuned to that particular rhythm of air, you're deaf. And so it does turn out that if the stimulus matches the receptor, we have perceptual experience. So far, so good. Another way to think about this, as Empedocles puts it, is that in order to be aware of something, in some sense, we have to, some part of us has to match it. Some part of us has to actually resemble or be a suitable receptor to that thing. Empedocles runs with this ball in a direction that most biological psychologists don't run. I'm wondering what I'm getting away with now that I'm the chair of the department, though. In that, what this is kind of implying, if you think about it, is that if we have to resemble any object in order to perceive it, then we have some kinship to that object. There's something alike or very, very similar about the two things. And if you want to take that to its total extension, then in some sense, any object we're aware of is actually us. We can even identify with the object that we're perceiving. And so that then raises the interesting question, who's doing the perceiving? If I am actually extremely similar to or identical to the object that I am perceiving, then it's probably equally reasonable to say the object is doing the perceiving. For with earth do we see earth, with water, water, with air, bright air, with fire, consuming fire, with love do we see love, strife, with dread, strife. A little bit about thinking. I think I'm running out of time. So how do does thinking work, according to Empedocles? Well, if you look into your own mind, you might notice, and I'm hoping you notice this, that your thoughts usually don't arise at random. One thought usually follows another because there's some similarity or resemblance between the two. So I'm thinking about dinner. And I'm thinking about dinner, what could I have for dinner? Maybe a pizza for dinner, maybe a pizza with some of those Sicilian anchovies on it, etc. If I was to think, what do I have for dinner? 47 stalks, the star Altair, green, purple, perfume, I have four legs. Those thoughts, I hope you noticed, didn't actually follow from each other. Most of the time, our thoughts follow what we might call trains of thoughts that are held together by some bond of similarity. Empedocles saw this as the manifestation of the great universal power that draws things together. So our thoughts are actually structured by a kind of attractive force that gives us a kind of mental architecture or patterns of thinking. And here he actually mentions the goddess Aphrodite. And so because our thoughts tend to stick together in this particular way, that leads to the human tendency to form habits. Because a habit is something that's been repeated over and over and over again until it kind of gets stuck that way. And so we all have habits of behaving. We also all have habits of thinking. And when we develop habits of thinking, we find it very hard to think things that we haven't thought before. Right? We only think in the same old grooves. Our trains of thought now have become chains of thought. And Empedocles warned against this as a kind of hypnosis practiced by Aphrodite on our thinking possibilities. And if all we can think is the same old thoughts, I think a chain of thought is an adequate metaphor. And of course it raises the question, if the architecture of our minds is caused by Aphrodite, to what extent do we own and control our own thinking? I told you, he's the father of insomnia. However, we do have the faculty of nous, and this is our little, tiny jailbreak opportunity, is this faculty of nous, which actually is the part of us that can observe this process and catch and not fall for the trick of identifying with our habitual chains of thinking. So, you are here. So, reincarnated, and Empedocles noticed or shared with us some of his previous lives. I've already been once a boy and a girl, a bush and a bird, and a leaping, journeying fish. Thank you for sharing. So, how did this happen, though? This is a very curious business. Because what's implied here is who we really are is the whole. And yet it doesn't seem that way. We seem to be these individuals stumbling around, identifying with these threads of cause and effect, these endless reincarnations. So somehow we have fallen from a state of wisdom to this confused predicament that we're in. One of the mistakes that happens somewhere along the line to produce us is mistaking a small part of what is real for the entire thing. And this is probably built on a more fundamental mistake, mistaking what I truly am, which is the whole, for only a little wee part of that. And so, under the spell of making these primordial cognitive errors, you might say, I've forgotten who I am. And as a result, I identify with something that is much, much smaller, much, much limited than what I truly am, who I truly am. And Empedocles has graphic descriptions of this human predicament that we're all in as beings called daimons. Now, in the old Greek, daimon is not a demon, it's not intrinsically like an evil, bad spirit, that kind of a thing, although it is the origin of the English word for demon. But Empedocles' portrayal of the daimonic condition is actually rather demonic. Almost in a perverted, confused, unconscious way of trying to regain our lost wholeness, we basically try and devour everything around us, right? To absorb all of the fragments so that we can actually feel whole again. In a nutshell, I've never seen a more succinct description of consumerism, by the way. Modern consumerism is based on the idea that I want you to buy my product, although you don't need it. So I will convince you that you're inadequate. You've got a hole inside yourself, and for a small fee, my product will actually fill that hole. Of course, I design it so that it doesn't work that way, so you want to buy more and more. And so the devouring daimon, that fundamental sense of inadequacy, we were constantly stuffing things into that hole, hoping we could restore our wholeness. It doesn't work. Devouring daimons. So we're in the volcano, we're in the mixing bowl, but we're lost in it, we're confused, as if we've kind of just pitched over the edge right into the thing. Another image that Empedocles presents for this world is he describes this world as a cave. And that's very striking because someone else, pretty soon after, also describes the world as a cave. The most famous of Plato's parables, the parable of the cave in the Republic. Prior to Plato, Empedocles said this world is a roofed cave. Now that can only mean one thing. This world is actually the underworld. We live in the underworld and we don't know it. That's a bad news, good news kind of situation. But it's a potentially good news situation if you're an initiate of Orphism, because remember that the underworld holds the possibility of the immortal transformation. Right? That's where Orpheus went to get it, that's where the initiates went to get it, and so the implication is that maybe it's available here. In a certain functional sense, this is the underworld. And if that's so, and if I can awaken to this potential of immortalization, then that's a good thing. So we have our matis, our human capacity, and that does at least give us a shot at not being fooled by the appearances. And hopefully we can mature into having the matis of a god, in which case we're not out of the volcano, we're not actually out of the mixing bowl, but we know where we are. And so that's the difference between falling into the pool and deliberately leaping into the pool with full awareness of what we're doing, what the potentials are of that particular situation. The story of the death of Empedocles that you perhaps heard of was, as far as we can tell, first written down over 700 years after Empedocles died. So are you wondering what people will say about you 700 years from now? Do you think they'll get it all right? Do you think maybe certain distortions might creep in? That's a possibility. So the most famous story of the death of Empedocles was written down, at least probably not invented by, but written down by Diogenes Laertius. And you probably know it goes like this. Empedocles was the shyster who wanted to trick people into thinking that he was an immortal god, but he realized that if he died and left the evidence of his corpse, that would kind of mess up the legacy. So he decided the best way of corpse disposal would be to jump into Mount Etna, and that would erase the evidence that he ever was mortal, and then everyone would think he was immortal, and you know, obviously he didn't leave anything lying around. However, so Diogenes wrote, Empedocles had a sort of a fashion kink as well. He liked to dress in bronze sandals. I invite you to try that. So Empedocles jumped in, you know, in his drag kit with the bronze sandals, and Etna erupted and spat out one of the bronze sandals, and somebody found it and realized what Empedocles had done, and it spoiled the entire effect. That's the version of Diogenes. Now, many scholars think that that's not what happened. Again, for one thing, to anyone's knowledge, is based on eyewitness accounts. To anyone's knowledge, no human being in antiquity actually wore bronze sandals. They're really not functional footwear, particularly. But someone else was associated with the bronze sandals in antiquity, namely the goddess Hecate, a goddess associated with the underworld, particularly associated with guiding people in the transition between the worlds of the living and the dead. And so here we have a tale several centuries after the death of Empedocles, likely garbled, but possibly holding a hint or memory of some kind of truth. It associates Empedocles with deliberately going into the mixing bowl or volcano. And it also associates him with the goddess of that kind of initiatic transition, namely the goddess Hecate. So it may well be that the slur of Diogenes Laertius from the 3rd century CE has a very distorted memory of some kind of initiatic tradition connected with Empedocles and immortalization. We'll probably never know for sure, but it does make some sense of it all. Questions, no answers. So, if this is the underworld, it has possibilities. So, Karen Medusa, how am I doing?
5 minutes.
Thank you, 5 minutes, okay. All right, this is going to be adumbrated a little bit. So, but that's good. This can function just as a teaser if you have realized some interest in Empedocles. Of course, you can go on to learn more about this. But in the surviving poetic fragments, Empedocles doesn't just sketch out the situation, as I've shared it with you this morning, he actually gives us some very interesting advice. Again, it's fragmentary, but it's quite intriguing. So what to do? Well, he gives these teachings, and you might think, well, this is good, I'll sit down, I'm going to memorize every detail and sort of work it all out. But that's not actually what Empedocles suggested that Pausanias do with his teachings. What he said is, take my teachings and plant them in your belly beneath your diaphragm. Your diaphragm, of course, is the breathing muscle. So in effect, he's saying, inhale my teachings, right? Breathe them in, actually take them in, plant them in the center of your body, and then take each of the words that comprise my teaching and split them. Now, if you go back into the Greek, this splitting actually is connected with the ancient art of grafting. In other words, grafting a stalk onto a branch in order to strengthen it. So we've got very interesting agricultural metaphors going on here. The planting, the grafting, the cultivating of the teaching. So you place it inside your body, you oversee the maturity of the teaching through your breathing. So that's an interesting way to look at it. You oversee the crop with goodwill and pure attention, paying attention to things in a way that's not entirely under the chains of habitual thinking and habitual perceiving. And he talks about nurturing the crop with the witnesses. And I suspect he's talking about paying attention to the phenomena of the sensory world. He's not someone who said, reject the world of the senses, turn away to some metaphysical transcendent thing, stop eating, whip yourself, and try and die. You know, that's a later development. He certainly said mistrust the senses, but he didn't say reject them as evil or worthless, because apprehended correctly, the senses are our teachers. They are the witnesses to the truth of this very teaching, as long as we're not fooled by their limitation. So, this is what you're supposed to do with the teaching. Graphically put. What else can I squeeze in there? Probably the final slide before the boom drops. So again, we've got this idea that we're not to turn away from the senses. So how do we use our senses? A few little bits of advice. He talks about pigments and pictures. So an artist will take a whole bunch of different pigments, we can call them the roots or elements, and paint an infinite number of different pictures. And the key thing is, we have to remember not to sort of freeze the pictures of things as if they're not ultimately just made of the pigments. So any object that we perceive, we mustn't freeze it into an independent reality. We should perceive it within the context of the mixing bowl, the constant comings together and separations of the elements. And it makes it a little easier not to be sucked into attachment to that object if we perceive its temporary nature in that regard. So there have been a lot of equality movements, and maybe this will be the next one, perceptual equality. Many of us privilege one of our senses. We tend to think one is the most dependable, one is the most reliable, and for many of us with an intact visual system, that privileged sense is vision. And Empedocles says it's useful to break that down. See how you can live by dethroning your privileged sense and try and grant each of your five or more senses kind of equal credibility. And it's a very interesting exercise. As you walk around or teach you, you might try this. For 5 minutes, focus your attention solely as much as you can on what you're seeing. Then switch. For 5 minutes, focus your attention solely as much as you can on hearing. Then switch again. Now, don't don't walk into traffic or anything. You obviously want to keep them all going, but you can foreground your senses in a sequence, and that tends to shake things up a bit. What we're doing here is shaking up the chains of habit, which infect and inflect the senses as well. So it's interesting kind of advice. He uses a metaphor, as I wrap up, uses a metaphor for the senses. Says that what you want to do is approach the world with each of your senses as an open palm. So he describes the senses as hands. Apparently, we approach the world in an ordinary sense with our hands clenched in, our senses clenched into metaphorical fists. Now, fists are great for a couple of things. You know, if I'm angry, fists are good for hitting things, or if I'm scared, they're good for, like, trying to keep away, or if I'm filled with an unbalanced kind of lust or desire, a fist can be for grasping. I'm trying to grasp the thing. And so imagine approaching the world not with the attitude of what can that thing do to me or what can that thing do for me, but just here it is. So instead of having a clenched perception, approach the world with open-handed perception. And who knows what the result of all of that may be. I think we're being directed to the inescapability of being in the volcano, but we do have a choice. We can fall in or we can jump in, following Parmenides. And so we've got some more days here in Syracuse. Perhaps by the end of it, if we all cultivate the unchaining of our thinking and the unclenching of our sensing, maybe by the end of our time together, we'll all hold hands and jump into the volcano. It's a fond wish. I'm out of time. I'm so grateful for your time.
Right out in the courtyard, those of us who are walking will follow LaLena and I.